The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly love.
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
I will ensure that Israel can defend itself from any threat, from Gaza to Tehran.
Americans want change.
Truth is, there's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
Your mission, you said, was to protect investors and detect fraud quickly. How'd that work out?
There comes a time in life when maintaining silence is but a betrayal of one's own spiritual core of being. Such a time has come, and I must declare from the expansion of my heart and over the limited sphere of my mind that I am a conscientious objector opposed to any and all wars.
We're done with it forever and ever, because we are the living and we will not be destroyed. If you make a war, if there are guns to be aimed, if there are bullets to be fired, if there are men to be killed, they will not be us. They'll not be us, the guys who grow wheat and turn it into food, the guys who make clothes and paper and houses and tiles, who build dams and power plants and string the long, moaning, high-tension wires, the guys who crack crude oil down into a dozen different parts to make light clothes and automobiles and sewing machines and shovels and airplanes and tanks and guns. Oh, no. No, it will not be us who die. It will be you. It will be you. You who urge us on to battle. You who incite us against ourselves. You who would have one cobbler kill another cobbler. You who would have one man who works kill another man who works. You who would have one human being who wants only to live kill another human being who wants only to live. Remember this. Remember this well, you people who plan for war. Remember this, you patriots, you fierce ones, you spawners of hate, you inventors of slogans. Remember this, as you have never remembered anything else in your lives. We are men of peace. We are men who work. And we want no quarrel. But if you destroy our peace, if you take away our work, if you try to range us one against the other, we will know what to do. If you tell us to make the world safe for democracy, we will take you seriously, and by God and by Christ, we will make it so. We will use the guns you force upon us. We will use them to defend our very lives. And the menace to our lives does not lie on the other side of a no man's land set apart without our consent. It lies within our own boundaries here. And now we've seen it, and we know it. Put the guns into our hands, and we will use them. Give us the slogans. We'll turn them into realities. Sing the battle hymns, and we'll take them up where you left off. Not one, not ten, not 10,000, not a million, not 100 million, not 1,000 million, but 1 billion, 2 billion of us. All the people of the world. We will have the slogans, and we will have the hymns, and we will have the guns, and we will use them, and we will live. Make no mistake of it. We will live. We will be alive, and we will walk and talk and laugh and sing and love and bear our children in tranquility, in security, in decency, in peace. You plan the wars, you masters of men. Plan the wars and point the way, and we will point the gun.
Hello and welcome to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. That was Donald Sutherland from the movie FTA, F the Army, with his monologue at the end, rather powerful. That, of course, was a documentary about the GI resistance movement and the sort of vaudevillian troupe that traveled the Pacific Rim entertaining GI resistors drafted to fight a war they didn't want. We're sort of in that situation. We're stuck with wars we don't want. I want to welcome all of our new listeners. Seeing Red Radio, about 2 weeks ago, decided to finally go into the internet and become a podcast. And about 3-4 days ago, I got put up on iTunes. And man, it's crazy. It's taken off. All of a sudden, there's all these people subscribing, looking for some revolutionary socialism on the radio. Welcome.
The conquistadors came with their sabers and guns, and they raped and they slaughtered until they were done. They hacked and they killed and left no one alive. Then they brought in the slaves they allowed to survive. Welcome to the new world, you could hear the men say, as they sat on the shores of Guantanamo Bay. After 400 years, independence was short. That's just how it is with the deep water port. The battleships came and they never left shore. Tasting the conquest, they just wanted more. The sign said, welcome to the U.S. of A. In the Republic of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. Past the barbed wire in the field of mines, you can see the men who left their families behind. To burn neath the sun, to be tortured and killed, where their stomachs are empty and their spirits are grilled. If you're looking for freedom, this is the price you must pay. It's written in blood on Guantanamo Bay. The vultures, they circle at ease overhead. The living may live and the dead will be dead. The time it may come in this tropical heat that they'll have to go somewhere else to eat. Maybe a storm will come wash it away. Still the guard towers glitter on Guantanamo Bay.
What gets people upset, and rightfully so, are executives being rewarded for failure.
So the government will cap senior executive salaries at $500,000 for any distressed bank getting a big bailout from the government.
Yeah, that's right. So what?
The stricter rules are not retroactive. They'll apply only to banks making new requests for help.
Well, first of all,
so they won't affect Bank of America, which has already received $45 billion in bailout funds. Its CEO, Ken Lewis, earned more than $5 million in salary and cash bonuses in 2007, and another $14 million in stock options and other income.
I'm the much maligned capitalistic boss.
Nor will it affect Wells Fargo, which has received $25 billion in TARP money. Its CEO, John Stumpf, took home more than $11 million in salary, bonus, and stock.
With all the money I've got, if you think I'm happy, I'm not. All I love my workers a lot, yet I treat.
In 1980, according to a Forbes magazine study, executive compensation was 40 times the average worker's pay. By 2007, that had soared to more than 400 times.
I am only human, even as you and you. Daddy, daddy, and I cannot help it no more than you. Or you, the things I do, I can't explain. Something is wrong with my brain.
But the president's swing wasn't quite as hard as it sounds. The new rules are aimed at only the most distressed companies. Even among the hundreds of banks getting TARP funds, very few executives will actually be affected by these new caps.
It can happen in a moment. Sometimes it does when what could be is and what shouldn't be was. There are times when you gotta stand steady. There are other times when you gotta be ready. The window can open, it seems so wide, but you can never tell when it's gonna slam shut. One day you're a target on the firing ranges, the next day all of a sudden everything changes. When it
It is now indeed critical moment for the large-scale anti-war movement. All of us who are mobilizing. March 21st, on that Saturday, Answer Coalition is organizing a protest on the 6th anniversary of the invasion on Iraq. Each of the prior mass actions opposing war and occupation took place while Bush was in office. Bush, the despised war criminal, became synonymous with empire and with the imperial invasion and bombing of Iraq, Afghanistan, the endless assault against the people of Palestine, and other brazen aggressions, all carried out under the banner slogan of the War on Terror. And when Bush was airlifted out of Washington, D.C. on a presidential helicopter on January 20th, 2009, the 2 million people assembled along the inaugural parade route and the National Mall let out an amazing, emotion-drenched expression of celebration. They cheered and screamed, clapped and grabbed, and hugged their partners and children. Bush was gone at last. Moments before, Bush's helicopter headed for the horizon, Barack Obama took the oath of office, and the celebration continued. Since racism has been such a dominant feature of this society for over four centuries, the election of the first African-American president was a historical moment that was steeped in symbolism and meaning for millions of people. Without discounting the jubilation over Bush's departure, however, in the anti-war movement and the social justice movement, we are acting to build a mass action on the 6th anniversary of the Iraq invasion, because the nightmare of war and occupation has not ended for the people of Iraq or Afghanistan or Palestine, nor has it ended for the people of the United States, who are forced to spend $1 trillion this year and every year on war expenditures while millions of families are losing their homes and jobs. 150,000 U.S. troops and another 200,000 private contractors, mercenaries, still occupy Iraq. Robert Gates, Bush's Secretary of Defense, who was retained by the incoming Obama administration as Pentagon chief, has promised that the U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan will double in the coming year. Both he and Vice President Joseph Biden are also promising an increase in casualties in the coming year. For the Palestinian people, the nightmare of U.S.-funded occupation has created thousands of fresh graves killed by U.S.-supplied F-16 fighter jets, Hellfire missiles, and attack helicopters. We, all of us, those of us, the endorsers of the March 21st mass action, have rejected the argument made by some in the peace movement that we shouldn't be in the streets right now because we have to give the new administration a chance to do the right thing. Frankly, that is an infuriating argument. Are the military contractors like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Halliburton quietly waiting for the president to quote-unquote do the right thing from their point of view? Are the biggest banks and oil giants like ExxonMobil waiting with arms folded to see how policy is shaped in the new administration? Are the architects of an expanding war in Afghanistan waiting to see the outcome of the debate? Are the advocates of Israeli aggression keeping quiet so that they don't step on the toes of the new White House State Department team? Far from waiting to see the outcome, the forces of militarism and corporate exploitation are working at full throttle to shape the direction of the country in the coming years. The progressive movement must step up the pressure, not step back. It must also recognize that while Bush became synonymous with militarism and war, these are dominant institutions in our society, and that's simply the reflection of policies associated with this or that elected official. Both the Republican and Democratic parties have embraced and promoted these same institutions. Barack Obama and the other candidates for the Democratic nomination were asked, 5 days before the South Carolina primary, if they thought they would have received the endorsement of Dr. Martin Luther King if he were alive today. Barack Obama, when he was running for office as a candidate promising change, responded to that question with the following comment, quote, I don't think Dr. King would endorse any of us. I think what he would call upon the American people to do is to hold us accountable. I believe change does not happen from the top down. It happens from the bottom up. Dr. King understood that. It was those women who were willing to walk instead of ride the bus. It was union workers who were willing to take on violence and intimidation to get the right to organize. It was women who decided, I'm as smart as my husband, I better get the right to vote. Then arguing, mobilizing, agitating, and ultimately forcing elected officials to be accountable. I think that's the key, end quote. Those words can be written off as appealing campaign rhetoric, or they can be put into practice in the critical months ahead. For our part, we know that change comes from the pressure of the mobilized people. That's where real power comes from, and that is the only antidote to the entrenched power of the military-industrial complex, which connects the banks, corporations, and the Pentagon war machine. Dr. King didn't stay out of the streets because a Democrat was in the White House, nor was the 1964 Civil Rights Act or the 1965 Voting Rights Act passed into law because of the beneficence of politicians. As then-candidate Obama correctly pointed out at the South Carolina debate, it was the arguing, mobilizing, and agitating that became the key to change. The March 21st march in the Pentagon is significant because it signals a determination by the progressive movement to stay in the streets, to expand the reach of the movement to draw in ever wider sectors of society, and to make the compelling argument about the interconnectedness of world politics and U.S. foreign policy with the badly needed struggle for economic and social justice at a moment of growing unemployment, foreclosures, and evictions, and deepening poverty. This movement can and must grow. The decision by you to endorse the upcoming march in the Pentagon will be so important because it tells everyone to keep your marching shoes on. It says to the people of the world that we, the people of the United States, can be partners in the struggle against an empire that speaks in our name, but not with our consent. That was a letter from Brian Becker, National Coordinator of the Answer Coalition, explaining why the march on March 21st in D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, and elsewhere is so important. I recommend endorsing this particular march. 1,300 people have done it. Seeing Red Radio has joined that list of endorsers. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. After this. The pledge to resist. To resist. To resist.
It's our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government
our name. Not in our name.
In 2006 with Hamas on the ballot.
We pledge resistance. Resistance.
It's an unshakable commitment to Israel's security.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world. Freedom and peace. To bring about justice. Freedom and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. Make it real. Make it real. Make it real.
I will ensure that Israel can defend itself from any threat, from Gaza to Tehran.
Victims of Americanism are waking up, and they're gaining a new political consciousness, becoming politically mature. And as they become develop this political maturity, they're able to see the recent trends in these political elections. They see that the whites are so evenly divided that every time they vote, the race is so close they have to go back and count the votes all over again. And which means that any bloc, any minority that has a block of votes that stick together is in a strategic position. Either way you go, that's who gets it. You're in a position to determine who go to the White House and who stay in the doghouse. You're the one who has that power. You can keep Johnson in Washington, D.C., or you can send him back to his Texas cotton patch. You're the one who sent Kennedy to Washington. You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they've brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump. In Washington, D.C., in the House of Representatives, there are 257 who are Democrats. Only 177 are Republican. In the Senate, there are 67 Democrats. Only 33 are Republicans. The party that you backed controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and still they can't keep their promise to you, because you're a chump. Anytime you throw your weight behind a political party that controls two-thirds of the government and that party can't keep the promise that it made to you during election time and you are dumb enough to walk around continuing to identify yourself with that party, you are not only a chump, but you're a traitor to your race.
Malcolm X in 1964, right here on Seeing Red Radio. Amidst the soaring unemployment in Iraq, the gravediggers have been busy. So busy that officials have no record of the number of graves dug, of the real death toll, that is. I've been working here 4 years, a gravedigger who gave his name as Ali told the IPS at the largest cemetery in Baghdad, a sprawling expanse in the Abu Ghraib section of the capital city. In 2006 and some of 2007, he said, we buried 40 to 50 people daily. This went on for 1.5 years. 25% of these were from violence, and another 70% were killed by the Mahdi army, the militia of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Only a few have appeared to have died from natural causes, from his account. He continues, most of the dead were never logged by anyone because we didn't check death certificates. We just tried to get the bodies into the ground as quickly as possible. An Iraqi army checkpoint was set up outside the vast cemetery a year ago. Quote, we opened this checkpoint because people were burying the dead and no information was even given to anyone, was end quote, which was spoken by a soldier who was speaking on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to speak to the media. Most of the lack of reporting of the dead we found happened during 2006, the soldier added. Anyone could be buried here and nobody would know about it, end quote. Not far in the Al-Hamia area of Baghdad, what used to be a park is now a cemetery with more than 5,000 graves. According to the manager, most of the dead are never counted. Most of the bodies buried here are never reported in the media, says Abu Ayad Nasir Walid, 45, manager of the cemetery, told the IPS. He had been the manager here since the park was converted into a cemetery amidst the bloodletting from sectarian violence in early 2006. I have the name here of the first martyr buried, Walid said, pointing to his tombstone. Gaith al-Samari, buried on the 21st of May, 2006. He was the sheikh of the Al Huria Mosque. Latif produced the cemetery logbook. As of this hour, exactly, there are 5,500 bodies in this place. I logged their names in my book, but we've never had anyone come from the government to ask how many people are here. Nobody in the media, nor the Ministry of Health, seems to be interested. Since graveyards, and there are many, raise questions about the real death toll in Iraq. The last serious study by a group of doctors in the U.S. and Iraq was published in the British peer-reviewed medical journal The Lancet on the 11th of October in 2006. The study said about 655,000 Iraqis, about 2.5% of the population, had been killed as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. The research was carried out on the ground by doctors moving from house to house, questioning families and examining death certificates. Homes were surveyed in the 47 separated clusters across Iraq. The Lancet says the study, carried out by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore in the United States, has been validated by 4 independent experts. The worst of the violence followed the 22nd February 2006 bombing of the Al-Askari Shrine in Samarra. The bombing of one of the most sacred Shia mosques in the world sparked sectarian violence that lasted months, with sometimes more than 300 killed in a day. Saud Abad Al-Latif, a gravedigger at the Al-Dadmahiyya Cemetery, told the IPS that during that time we buried 30 to 40 bodies daily. Often we had to work through the night, otherwise the bodies would just remain outside. Some estimates of the death toll have been considerably lower than that of The Lancet, the group Iraq Body Count, the IBC, which describes itself as an ongoing human security project, estimates the number to be 98,850 as of the time of this writing. The group says on the methodology, quote, deaths in the database are derived from a comprehensive survey of commercial media and NGO-based reports, along with official records that have been released into the public sphere, end quote. IBC adds that figures are included from incident-based accounts to figures from hospitals, morgues, and other documentary data-gathering agencies. The website adds, however, that IBC's main sources are information-gathering and public agencies, principally the commercial news media who provide web access to their reports. Also, the IBC only records violent deaths and only those of civilians. The unofficial cemeteries around Iraq hold their own additions to the numbers doing the rounds, and no one knows what these add up to. That's an article entitled Iraq, No Unemployment Among Gravediggers, written by the independent journalist Dar Jamal. You can find that on the website ipsnews.net. Or go to the Seeing Red Radio website at seeingredradio.org. You can download all of the information as well as a link to the podcast of this broadcast. Again, you're listening to Seeing Red Radio. Please stay tuned.
Making the same mistakes. So love your face.
Cool new world leaders, cooling all systems of control, cooling all of them secret committees. We're watching and we're waiting while you're all below your mind. We're watching and we're waiting while you're all below your mind.
And the world is screaming, but the drugs make you dead. Bring your blunted needles, better
Asian Dub Foundation right here on Seeing Red Radio with Altered Statesman. The global economic crisis could see more than 50 million jobs lost around the world, according to the International Labor Organization's ILO latest report on employment. The ILO has stated in its 2009 Global Employment Trends report that depending on the effectiveness of recovery efforts and timeliness, global unemployment could this year increase on 2007 figures by between 18 and 30 million, and by more than 50 million if the situation continues to deteriorate. And in this worst-case scenario, some 200 million workers, mostly on developing economies, could be forced into extreme poverty. The global recession is also expected to lead to a dramatic increase in the number of people joining the ranks of the working poor and those in vulnerable employment. The ILO message is realistic and not alarmist. We are now facing a global jobs crisis. Most governments are aware and acting, but more decisive and coordinated international action is needed to avert a global social recession. Progress in poverty reduction is unraveling, and middle classes worldwide are weakening.
Woke up this morning, London, scratch my skin. Think to myself, now what would this day bring? Day after day, spend walking the town. I play the fool and act the clown. But it's my fault that I'm unqualified. Cliff from J.A., written to reside as an unemployed member of the public. Yeah, yeah, as an unemployed member of the public. Yeah, 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 now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed. It's not that I'm afraid of work, you see. I'll build computers, even chop down trees. The parents tell me that I'm just no damn good. They're better off with a man of wood. So help me, brothers, now help me if you can. But after all, I'm just a human man, just not an unemployed member of the public. Yeah, yeah, just not an unemployed member of the public. Yeah, 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 now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed now. Look who's unemployed.
South African dockers refuse to unload Israeli ship. In a historic development for South Africa, South African dock workers have announced their determination not to offload a ship from Israel that is scheduled to dock in Durban on Sunday, February 8th. This follows the decision by Kusato to strengthen the campaign in South Africa for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against apartheid Israel. The pledge by Satawu members in Durban reflects the commitment by South African workers to refuse to support oppression and exploitation across the globe. Last year, Durban dock workers had refused to upload a shipment of arms that had arrived from China and were destined for Zimbabwe to prop up the Mugabe regime and to intensify the repression against the Zimbabwean people. Now, says Satawu's General Secretary Randall Howard, the union members are committing themselves to not handling Israeli goods. Satawu's actions on Sunday will be part of a proud history of worker resistance against apartheid. In 1963, just 4 years after the anti-apartheid movement was formed, Danish dock workers refused to offload a ship with South African goods. When the ship docked in Sweden, Swedish workers followed suit. Dock workers in the San Francisco Bay Area and later in Liverpool also refused to offload South African goods. South Africans, and the South African working class in particular, will remain forever grateful to those workers who determinedly opposed apartheid and decided that they would support the anti-apartheid struggle with their actions. Last week, Western Australian members of the Maritime Union of Australia resolved to support the campaign for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, and have called for a boycott of all Israeli vessels and all vessels bearing goods arriving from or going to Israel. This is the legacy and the tradition that South African dock workers have inherited, and it is a legacy that they are determined to honor by ensuring that South African ports of entry will not be used as transit points for goods bound for or emanating from certain dictatorial and oppressive states such as Zimbabwe, Swaziland, and Israel. Kusatu, the Palestinian Solidarity Committee, the Young Communist League, and a range of other organizations salute the principled position taken by these workers. We also take this opportunity to salute the millions of workers all over the world who have openly condemned and taken decisive steps to isolate apartheid Israel, a step that should sound shockwaves to its arrogant patrons in the United States who foot the bill for Israel's killing machine. We call on other workers and unions to follow suit and to do all that is necessary to ensure that they boycott all goods to and from Israel until Palestine is free. We also welcome statements by various South African Jews of conscience who have disassociated themselves from the genocide in Gaza. We call on all South Africans to ensure that none of our family members are allowed to join the Israeli occupation forces killing machine. In celebration of the actions of Satawu members with regard to the ship from Israel and in pursuance of the campaign for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, and our call on the South African government to sever diplomatic and trade relations with Israel, this coalition of organizations has declared a week of action beginning on Friday, February 6th, tomorrow. These actions will be organized under the theme Free Palestine, Isolate Apartheid Israel. That came from the media conference of the Kusatu House. It was given out just a few days ago. That, of course, Kusatu is the major union of South African dockers who refuse to unload Israeli ships.
As you can see, your portfolio has performed really well this year.
Energy stocks are up and technology is strong. You took a little hit in real estate, but more than made up for it in genocide. You're really making a killing.
If you listen to my friends on the other side of the aisle, they believe this is the answer to every ill. If the economy is flourishing, more tax cuts. If the economy is struggling, more tax cuts. Well, tax cuts have their place and they're part of this, but they're not the complete answer.
The notion that everything is solved by a tax cut, of course there are sensible tax policies you can have, but there are public needs we have in this society. that cannot be accomplished by a tax cut. No tax cut builds a road. No tax cut puts a cop on the street. No tax cut educates a child. Understand what you mean?
This is the largest spending bill in history, and we're trying to call it a stimulus when it's just doing the things that you want to do anyway.
The largest spending bill in history is going to turn out to be the war in Iraq. And one of the things, if we're going to talk about spending, I have a problem when we leave out that extraordinary expense of damaging war in Iraq, which has caused much more harm than good, in my judgment. And I don't understand why, from some of my conservative friends, building a road, building a school, helping somebody get health care, that's wasteful spending. But that war in Iraq, which is going to cost us over $1 trillion before we're through, yeah, I wish we hadn't done that. We'd have been in a lot better shape fiscally.
That is a whole other show. So I'm going to go
on. That's the problem. The problem is that we look at spending and say, oh, don't spend on highways, don't spend on health care, but let's build Cold War weapons to defeat the Soviet Union when we don't need them. Let's have hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars going to the military without a check. Unless everything's on the table, then you're going to have a disproportionate hit in some places.
My team and I tried our best to get the SEC to investigate and shut down the Madoff Ponzi scheme, with repeated, incredible warnings to the SEC that started in May 2000, when the Madoff Ponzi scheme was only a $3 to $7 billion fraud. We knew then that we had provided enough red flags and mathematical proofs to the SEC for them, where they should have been able to shut him down right then and there at under $7 billion. But unfortunately, the SEC staff lacks the financial expertise and is incapable of understanding the complex financial instruments being traded in the 21st century. In October 2001, when Madoff was still in the $12 to $20 billion range, again, we felt confident that we had provided even more evidence to the SEC, such that he should have been stopped at well under $20 billion. And again, in November 2005, when Mr. Madoff was at $30 billion, 29 red flags were handed to the SEC, and yet again, they failed to properly investigate and shut down Mr. Madoff's operation. Unfortunately, as they didn't respond to my written submissions in 2000, 2001, 2005, 2007, and 2008, here we are today. A fraud that should have been stopped at under $7 billion in 2000 has now grown to $50 billion. I know that you want to know why there were over $40 billion in additional damages, and I hope to be able to provide some of those answers to you today.
I mean, I think the question of what capitalism is clearly a much more important question today than it has been for a long time, because we're posing the question at a time when you have a rising movement around the world that has often been called an anti-capitalist movement. Sometimes it's been called a global justice movement. But whatever you call that movement, it's clearly aimed against the very logic of that system, the way the system destroys people's lives around the planet, the way the system leads to war, and everything that goes along with that. And I just want to start the meeting off, really, by raising three very sort of quick ways in which answering this question is actually very, very fundamental to try to understand how to build the most effective, biggest possible movement against capitalism. And the three reasons are these. First of all, I think it's incredibly important that we understand the nature of the problem, the nature of the system that we're up against. You see, within the movement, it's often argued, and it's become a bit of a cliche now, that we all know what we're against, we have different ideas about what we're for. And at one level, that is true. But also, I think there is, within the movement, quite a large range of ideas of exactly what it is we're against. For example, if you take the organisation Attack France, which a few years ago was quite a central part of the anti-capitalist movement, was absolutely central to launching the World Social Forum, and reflected really the real anger in France at the time against the system. It's very clear that what they're against, I'm going to read a quote from one of their leaders, Bernard Cazdan, is certain elements of the capitalist system. He writes in a recent article, "That's why our slogan, another world is possible, amounts to something like a cultural revolution. It means that we are not condemned to neoliberalism. We can envisage other ways of living and organising society than those we have at present." What Bernard Cazdan is saying is that we're against simply the neoliberal consequences of capitalism. What he means by that is the privatisation of public services, the third world debt, and in particular for him, financial speculation. If you read some of the other books that are coming out at the moment, George Monbiot, for example, who spoke at Marxism earlier in the week, for him, he wants what he calls a global democratic revolution, a much more far-reaching change that brings in a world parliament that regulates world trade in a much more fair and just way. But really, his set of ideas leaves open a number of questions. In the kind of society he envisages, would you still have an unequal distribution of wealth? Of course it would be slightly more equal, but would there still be those deep inequalities? Would you still have sexism, racism, homophobia? Would you still have wars? These are very, very open questions. And really, I think when you go into the question, what I'm going to argue is that for Marxists, although these kind of limited struggles within the capitalist system are incredibly important, and what George Monbiot says and what attacks of France say is incredibly important, that these problems are actually bound up with a far deeper set of problems. Really, a set of problems to do with the very fundamental relationships upon which capitalism is based. And in order to build a just, democratic, fair world, I'm going to argue we need a much more far-reaching revolution in society. And to have that revolution, you have to understand what Karl Marx called the laws of motion of capitalist society. So that's the first reason. We need to understand what capitalism is so we can understand what we're up against, what the nature of the problem is. Secondly, and connected to this, I think understanding how the capitalist system works is very important if you want to understand the kind of world we could build, the kind of human potential that could potentially be unlocked. What do I mean by that? Well, really, for thousands of years now, society has been characterized by different struggles, different groups of oppressed people rising up. And whenever that's happened, the people who've been oppressed, who are starting to fight back, begin to dream of a different kind of world, a different way of running society. And sometimes these dreams are very, very far-reaching. I'll give you one example. There's hundreds of examples you could choose from. I want to quote a guy called Win Stanley. This was a guy who was a part of the English Revolution that took place in the 17th century, so it's going back a few centuries. There's a quote from his which goes, "When this universal law of equity rises up in every man and woman, then none shall lay claim to any creature and say, this is mine, that is yours. This is my work, that is yours." What he's arguing for is a complete revolutionising of society, complete equality in human relations, equality of property, a very even, fair, democratic society, the kind of thing we all aspire to, I think. Nonetheless, at that time, in the 17th century, this was really a completely utopian dream. In the 17th century, there is no way that the world system that existed at that time could deliver food, clothing and shelter consistently to every person on the planet. There was no way that you could escape from the conditions of scarcity. There's no way that there was any kind of material basis for this kind of equality. I'm going to argue in this meeting, I'm going to follow Marx's argument, that capitalism, for the first time, does create this potential. So that's the second reason. We want to understand what capitalism is so we can understand what kind of world we can build if we actually manage to overthrow the system. The final reason, which is going to be developed throughout this course, I don't want to go on any length about it, but we have to understand the nature of the capitalist system for a very important reason, because once we understand the nature of the system, we can understand where our side is strongest and their side is weakest. Once we understand how the system works, we can adopt the right strategy to actually overthrow that system.
And that's this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. For links to articles or music that you heard, or if you'd like to support Seeing Red Radio, check out the website at seeingredradio.org. Welcome to all the new iTunes podcast subscribers. Seeing Red Radio is taking off. Peace, comrades. Check you next week.
The guy threw a shoe at me. No, I consider it an important step on the road toward an Iraq that can sustain itself, govern itself, and defend itself.